Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Coming up, we ask scientists about the scientific ideas they target for an early retirement. But first, as you slide your bags past the scanner, you put your shoes back on, head down the airport concourse to your gate. Take a moment to look outside. See all that open space? No, not the concrete that the planes are rolling on, but the space around the runways, next to the control tower, that buffer land set up between the airport and the other properties. Doesn't seem like a great natural habitat, does it? But at several airports around the world, hundreds of thousands of creatures are calling that space home. We're talking bees. Yeah, it started in Germany, but now several U.S. cities have beehives habituating airports. Joining me now is Bob Redman. He's a beekeeper and executive director of the Common Acre. That's a group that has partnered with SeaTac Airport in Seattle to set up an airport apiary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
How many bees are we talking about out there?
Well, in reality, you said hundreds of thousands, but it's really in the millions.
Millions? How many millions?
Yeah. Well, it varies.
How many hives do you have?
We have 25 hives, and then in addition to those, you have to include all of the wild bees in the area as well.
Wow. So you have the residential bees, and then the interlopers are coming in.
Exactly.
How did you get started with this?
Well, I read about Chicago O'Hare's efforts to keep bees, and as a beekeeper and an ecologist, I thought, what can we do here in Seattle?
And so you went out to the airport, and they said, what a great idea. Let's do this tomorrow.
Yeah, well, you know, tomorrow plus a year and a half, but it was really, it was pretty amazing because I kept throwing ideas at them. Yeah. Can we put some honeybee hives at the airport? Can inside the perimeter fence? Can we put an art exhibit inside the main terminal? And oh yeah, since that golf course is closing, can we plant that all with pollinator habitat? And each step along the way, they kept saying yes. They've been a great partner.
Wow, you know, if you look out at an airport, the land doesn't look like it's a great habitat. These scrubby grass, that kind of stuff. Is that actually good for the bees? Do they like that?
Yeah, well, and I think there's a human element, too, that we need to make it good for them. But that's, I think, something that people living in cities have to start to consider now, which is more than backyard gardens or even parking strips. What land is available to make an agricultural use out of? And so we're looking at land at the airport, land under power lines with the electric utilities, medians, and corporate land. There's a lot of land that we can do something with.
So you're saying then that this isn't a project that's just about honeybees. It's about using all that land for agriculture.
Absolutely, Ira. The honeybee is sort of the poster child for bees. And when people think, I want to save the bees, they think of that one first. But in reality, there are 4,000 species of bees in North America, and only one of them is the honeybee. Granted, we do the most with that bee. It's the only species, or not the only, but it's the main species of bee that we do depend on for agricultural pollination. But the point of this project is to look at the whole picture, and that's why we're planting pollinator habitat. We have the first 20 acres underway, and we're studying what kinds of bees are even there because a lot of that data isn't even available yet.
Well, what kind of stuff do you plant that you think the bees would like?
Well, it's a mix of trees and shrubs and flowers, and we're also trying to – there's a couple other things that are trying to happen. We're trying to keep out invasive species. But bottom line, we prepared a list of 100 plants for the airport, and we're in the first wave of putting some of those in, and those include big leaf maple, some native willow to this area, a bunch of ceanothus, California lilac. These are all really good plants for a variety of pollinators.
Well, if you've got 25 hives, you've got a fair amount of honey coming out of that. What happens to the honey? You take it home?
We process that. We basically put it into jars. There isn't any real processing to it besides that. And we sell that to help underwrite some of the costs. all those artists that I mentioned, mm-hmm. they all got paid to be part of this project. We want to support them, and there's a lot of work that has to go on to do these scientific studies. And so the port is doing that mainly, but we're supplementing that with sales of the honey.
Now, I know that you have other urban hives. How do the airport hives compare to those?
Well, it's really interesting because this isn't agricultural land and there's nothing on it, in fact, by design, that is supposed to produce food. So the bees are foraging wild forage. And granted, a lot of that here is blackberry because that's an invasive species. But besides that, it's a lot of what would be normally considered weeds, like fireweed, or there's echinacea, or other things that grow out in the wild. Dandelions, clover, which nobody's really tending. In an agricultural setting, you'd get, you know, plans like we want these fruit trees to be pollinated, or we want this set of things that we're growing in our gardens in the city to be pollinated. And the honeys taste different. The airport honey tastes wild and kind of woody and grassy, and the backyard honeys taste sweeter and more fruity.
Yeah, there's an amazing range of, my brother is a beekeeper, an amazing range of flavors and natural and raw honey. But being on an airport, one of my first thoughts was it's a great spot. You know, I've heard of other beekeepers. I've heard of people even putting goats, right? Goats to keep control of weeds on highway medians even. Is there any worry, though, at an airport, which is full of fumes, the exhaust from all those jet planes? Any worry that you're contaminating the bees or the honey or the stuff that they're eating?
Sure. There's a lot of fuel being burned at the airport, just like there would be on any freeway. And the interesting thing, though, is that the airport is really highly regulated for that stuff. And the airport themselves would give you the details on how that happens. But I can tell you that on my site, I've seen so much wildlife. I've seen coyotes. There's a salmon run behind one of our apiaries, wild songbirds, rabbits.
Wow.
There's a lot of biodiversity there, kind of all up and down the food chain. And this honey has actually been lab tested to be negative for any heavy metals, so which is better than some of the honeys that we've tested from the city.
Hmm. So let's say there's an airport administrator or some official at a city who's listening to us now and wants to get involved in putting beehives in their airport. Give them some advice.
Well, my first advice is don't worry about honeybees. Worry about what is in the ground and what's happening in the soil and what plants are coming out of it. That's the first thing that anybody can do. And it's probably the most beneficial for the native insect communities that are already there. That's how to bolster them. What we did with the honeybees was kind of make it part of a program, because we know once you put a picture up of an airplane and a bunch of honeybees flying around, people are going to say, "What is that?" And it's just, you know, it's not as sexy if you put a handful of tube nesting or ground nesting bees that you can hardly see. And what's the story? They're out in the field. So we're kind of crafting a story here, but it doesn't necessarily depend on honeybees. And our hope is that it won't have to.
Are there airports doing? Has this caught on all around the world?
Well, I can tell you, as you mentioned, it originated in Germany, and they are testing air quality by testing the honey there. That's something that they've done. In the United States, O'Hare's initial focus was on employee training, how to train people to be beekeepers, and not any people either. It was former prisoners, so I'm trying to teach them a new skill, and I know they've been really successful at that. And then our focus is on ecological development and urban agriculture. And yeah, I've gotten a lot of inquiries from places that are interested, people in San Francisco, people in Denver, and I know that St. Louis has some honeybee hives from a commercial beekeeper on their property. So there's different ways to approach it, and the big question is, how do we use our land in a more holistic way?
You know, right here in New York, Kennedy Airport sits on Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge already. There's a big wildlife park there. It would be a great place to put some beehives, I would think.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you heard from them at all? Have you shown any interest?
No, I haven't. I haven't talked to that group of New York beekeepers yet. The people I know, well, the marriage of urban and agricultural in New York is what I know of is happening a lot in Brooklyn on rooftop beekeeping
right,
and
right.
Just became
legal a little while ago to keep bees in the city.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
But there is a lot of land out there that's open but somewhat off limits to people. As I say, the highway medians and such, would that land be suitable for bee projects? You know, if you're driving along?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. There isn't any real utility to grass other than it's easy to maintain. So, you know, immediately I would suggest looking at any kind of areas like that. And speaking of New York, you go back to when the Olmsted brothers planned Central Park in the 19th century, and how important was that decision to what happened to the growth of that city? I think we're facing a similar juncture here where we're looking at increasing urban development and decreasing land availability. So we have to say, what is available, and are we going to really plant it all with grass, or are we going to plant something that can make a difference?
And now that we have colony collapse in so many hives,
An issue. That's an issue primarily with the industrial beekeeping industry, and it's specifically because of the way the industrial food system works, which is highly dependent on monocropping and monopollinating too, because they only use that one bee. When you start to diversify, those problems go away.
And that's what you're doing, is what you're saying.
That's the gist of this project, is create biodiversity. And not only that, but communicate that to the general public, because as you can appreciate, science is hard to get our heads around sometimes. So we have to tell a story that will really motivate people.
Better words than I could have put it. Thank you. Very well put.
You're very welcome.
Bob Redman is a beekeeper, executive director of the Common Acre. That's in Seattle, Washington, and he was involved at SeaTac Airport out there. Thanks for joining us today, and good luck to your beekeeping.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we're going to talk about what scientific idea do you think is ready for retirement? Do we need a falsifiability? Do we need that in science anymore? Is that an idea that needs to be retired? How about the universe, the idea of the universe, one big universe? Is that an ancient idea? We'll get your opinions. Our number, 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In science, we're always looking for the new idea, the new theory that explains the data better than any idea that's come before. Ptolemy's geocentric model explains some of what we observe about the cosmos, but then a new idea came along with even greater explanatory power. New ideas are born, old ones fade. Just ask Copernicus. What if those old ideas don't fade quite fast enough? Could we give them a little push out the door? That's the question asked by a new collection of essays entitled This Idea Must Die. Editor John Brockman asked 175 scientists and big thinkers about the scientific ideas they target for extinction. And two of the contributors to that collection are here to tell us what they think must go. Their targets, the universe and falsifiability. Weighty questions. What do you think? Let me introduce my guest. Seth Lloyd is a professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Ira. It's great to be back.
Thank you. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech in Pasadena. Good to have you back, Sean.
Hi there, Ira.
And if you want to follow along, you can read Dr. Carroll and Dr. Lloyd's essays at our website right now. Go to sciencefriday.com/thisideamustdie. You can even vote on whether you agree or disagree with what they're suggesting. Let's get into that right now. Seth, let me ask you first, what do you think of this idea of eliminating outdated ideas? Does it have some scientific baggage? You know, do we need to get rid of that when it's outdated?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the main ways to make new discoveries is to discard useless baggage. My postdoctoral supervisor, Murray Gell-Mann, said that most new ideas are not actually coming up with new ideas, but actually realizing that your old prejudices can just be tossed out the window.
Sean, you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all grow up learning science in a certain way, and it's very, very difficult sometimes to realize that what we thought were cherished and inviolable presuppositions are, in fact, ready for the trash can.
Now, I'm going to have a senior moment. I can't remember the scientist who said that scientists die at the funerals of other scientists.
Every scientist has said that.
He's dead, so don't worry. I mean, she.
Well, let's talk about some of the big ideas that you guys have taken on. Seth, You believe that the universe needs to die. Tell us what you mean by that.
So I think it's time for the notion of the universe as just being the universe, just the cosmos, galaxies, stars, and planets, what we can see through telescopes. It's time for that idea to go and buy a condo in Florida. I'm assuming that the universe can find a condo big enough.
Why is that? What's wrong with the concept that we have?
Well, I mean, it's a very appealing notion and has been around for many thousands of years that the only thing that's out there is that what we can see up there in the sky. The problem is that over the last few decades, modern theories of how the universe came into existence show that there should be not just one universe, but a gajillion universes. That's a technical term, by the way.
Sean, what do you think of Seth's idea? Are you ready to get rid of the universe, the single universe?
Well, I think we should be open-minded. I think we should be epistemically humble about things like this, because the answer is we just don't know. I think we should be very, very willing to come to a conclusion someday that the universe we see is not nearly all there is. That would be highly parochial of us to think otherwise. But I think that the state of the art isn't quite ready to draw any conclusions yet.
We made a very unscientific poll on our website, and we asked our listeners to vote, and about 70% of them were happy to see the universe go.
Seth, you've actually written
a eulogy for the universe, right? We're going to lay down this idea to rest right now. So, Seth, give us.
I'll be as somber as I can. Thank you, dear friends, for gathering here today to honor our late friend, the universe. God was sorry she couldn't come, but she sent flowers. I know that some of you were surprised to hear that the universe was not eternal, but had been around for a mere 13.8 billion years. Over the last few years, the universe had been agitated not only by this sense of finiteness, but by the news that it was not the universe, but only one of an infinite number of possible universes. The shock brought on by its new ordinariness evidently led to the universe's untimely demise. Let us take a moment, however, to remember some of the wonderful gifts the universe brought us. Galaxies, stars, and planets, a place to live, and of course, life itself. Had we not been nurtured by its bounty, we would never have come to the point of being able to trace the universe back to its origins. The discovery that the universe was not licked out of the salty lip of a fiery pit by a giant cow also led to the universe's recent sense of rootlessness. And it led us to make the discovery that the universe was just one cosmos out of an infinite multitude. Rather than mourning its passing, let us instead celebrate the universe's uniqueness and special place amongst this infinity of other universes. It is, after all, the only universe that we have ever known. We come not to bury the universe, but to praise it.
Wow. I'm getting all misty.
Spent too many years in chapel as a child.
A little verklempt.
Yes, Sean. Let me ask, Sean, let's talk about what you may have bitten off the biggest sacred cow in science, and that is the idea of falsifiability, the idea that you can test everything in a scientific theorem, and that's the bedrock of science. You want to do away with the idea that we have to test everything.
Well, not precisely. I think that what's going on here is that falsifiability is a philosophical concept, an attempt to demarcate science from non-science. And it's not a very sophisticated philosophical concept. It's not the thing that a modern philosopher of science would say is the right way to do that. But it's a very catchy motto. So scientists who, by disposition, tend to not like philosophy have sort of captured this one little thing that they can pull out and put on a T-shirt about falsifiability, and then they treat this as if that's how science should be done. I think we just need to be a little bit more sophisticated and careful when drawing those distinctions.
Mm-hmm. But let's say you take a theory like string theory, which has been around for decades and we really can't test it yet. I mean, we don't have, right? It's really not testable. We need giant energies that we can't make in the laboratory.
That's right.
If you can't test it in science, doesn't science say, well, if it's not testable, it really is a nice theory, but it's not really science anymore?
Well, again, I think you need to be a little bit careful about those things. A scientific theory needs to be specific. It needs to say some things are true and some things are not true. The original person who put forward falsifiability as a criterion, Karl Popper, he was really thinking about things like Freudian psychoanalysis. He thought that no matter what happened to a person, to their conscious perceptions, you could always tell a Freudian psychoanalytic story about it. Whereas string theory says something very specific. It says that if you look at what goes on very, very small scales, you will see little strings rather than little particles. The fact that we don't have microscopes or particle accelerators that are actually able to do that is completely beside the point.
But if you say to me, you know, you just have to take it on faith, the math is good, that this is real because we can't really get the data on this, isn't
right,
that sort of a religion?
Nobody ever says that. That is a complete weird, bizarre straw man of the position.
Well, tell us about that.
What you say, in fact, the way that you judge scientific theories is the way you judge anything. You say, what would the world be like if this theory were true? What would the world be like if this theory were not true? And then you look at the world. String theory says that there should be gravity in the world, for example, and we see gravity, so that's a point in its favor. String theory says there should be 10 dimensions of space-time, and we don't see 10 dimensions of space-time, so that's a point against it. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to develop the theory to the point where we can match up those predictions with the data in a sufficiently elaborate and precise way that we can pass judgment. It's always about what theory best accounts for the data.
Seth, where do you stand on this?
Well, you know, as Freud once said, sometimes a Calabi-Yau manifold is just a Calabi-Yau manifold. I'm inclined to agree with Sean. And there's a famous story that somebody told Feynman that an experiment contradicted his theory, thereby falsifying it. And Feynman said, "Well, the experiment is obviously wrong." Right. So, it frequently happens that, you know, that we have experimental evidence that points against a theory, and then we realize later that the experiment was messed up. So we shouldn't take falsifiability too seriously. Also, it really is a kind of a philosophical construct. On the other hand, I think that if Apple gave up the concept of falsifiability in the process of designing and testing iPhones, you should switch to another brand.
If they gave it up, you're saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that, you know, if you look at more empirically based sciences and engineering, which is kind of ultimately empirically based science, then you know, you really can't make progress unless you have a close interaction between theory and experiment, and you constantly use experiment to test and to discard theories that don't work. I mean, this, of course, is the problem in string theory. I mean, string theory very well may be true, but it's going to be pretty hard for us to test it and to show that it actually is true. Meanwhile, if you were to kind of drop the notion of falsifiability into making a design for an electronic circuit, like for your iPhone, I think you would find that circuit would not work.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think science is going on this, and Sean? You think they're going to go behind you, or are we going to have to wait for those funerals to happen before this idea is accepted?
Yeah, you know, it might take a long time, but ultimately everyone will agree with me about this, I am pretty sure. I think that there is an interesting question underlying this, and it goes back to Seth's idea of getting rid of the concept of the universe, which is that modern physics and cosmology often deal with theoretical constructs that are very hard to directly test. And so there's two things that we need to accept about that. One is it might take a long time. I mean, to say string theory has been around for decades is an extremely annoying statement to a string theorist. Atomic theory was around for millennia before we were able to test it. That didn't make it wrong. The other thing is it might be that we can never know for sure. It might be that string theory is right, or it might be that we live in a multiverse with different regions looking very, very different, and yet we are never able to collect enough specific data or make enough specific theoretical predictions to know for sure whether that's right. And in that case, okay, that's how we will be. But that doesn't make the theory non-scientific. It just means that we will never be sure whether the theory is right.
But what practical value does that have about knowing how the universe actually works?
Well, hopefully we will know. I mean, I'm just saying that there is a pessimistic scenario in which we never figure it out, but we have learned a tremendous amount about quantum field theory and quantum gravity by thinking about string theory. We have focused our cosmological observations, and we have spent millions of dollars looking at the universe because of predictions made on the basis of inflation and the cosmological multiverse. They may or may not pan out, but our job is to try to understand the universe and be open to its possibilities, not to decide ahead of time that a certain theory shouldn't be considered because we don't yet know how to test it.
Okay. Seth, you were going to say something?
Oh, yeah, I agree with John about this. And indeed, it's by studying our part of the universe, our branch of the multiverse, carefully and looking at ideas from theories such as string theory and quantum gravity that have led us to realize, heck, there's got to be a whole bunch of other universes out there in the multiverse. When we look at our own physical theories that have been tested empirically, we can easily come to the conclusion that there is much more out there that we will never be able to test empirically.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. By the way, we also did an unscientific poll of our sci-fi voters who were split about 50-50, Sean. On this idea.
See, that's because I'm more avant-garde than Seth is. So.
But it is nonetheless empirical.
The public has not caught up to me yet.
I would have to disagree with you about what Richard Feynman would have thought about this, because I did a lot of research on his quotes, and he seemed to be on the empirical side of this a lot of times.
It's not empirical side is not the other side. Everyone is on the empirical side.
Uh-huh.
There is no non-empirical side to be on. Seth's story is completely true. Feynman had a theory that he knew was very successful. It had been tested in some ways. One experiment came along that seemed to be against it, and Feynman said, in his judgment, given how well the theory had been doing, he thought it was more likely the experiment was wrong than the theory. Einstein has done the same thing. Scientists do this all the time. Doing experiments and collecting data is kind of a mess, and we have to understand the give and take between our theoretical understanding and our observations of the world.
All right, see if we get a quick phone call in here. Let's go to Matthew in Dallas. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
One thing I have to say is that I'm finishing my PhD in mathematical physics, so it's really sort of awesome to be on at the moment.
I think we lost his cell phone.
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, quickly.
I'm here. Okay, the thing I had to say about falsifiability was that, usually we're talking about this in the sense of Karl Popper. However, Imre Lakatos and his idea of research programs sort of solved a lot of these problems, and whether or not something may be falsifiable or testable at the moment versus whether or not it is testable as a proposition at some time in the future, and giving ideas a chance to grow enough to be judged in that way.
Giving ideas, yeah. Well, that goes along with what Sean is saying.
It does, and I think the lesson here is that scientists should respect the field of philosophy of science and realize that it's a very complicated and subtle thing and spend their time doing science rather than repeating mottos that they learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that actually it's a much more rough and tumble thing. The interplay between theory and experiment resembles professional wrestling more than it resembles Karl Popper's ideas. The theorist gets up and the experimentalist whops him with a chair.
Well, the old argument between experimentalists and theorists, one more time. Is there another idea that you think should be done away with, Seth? Any other come to mind?
If I knew what ideas we could get, we could toss out, then I would have another great idea.
Okay, Sean, do you have one?
Well, I think that space is overrated, actually. Space as in space and time. I think that it's important, it's real and it exists, but I don't think it's fundamental. I think that once we understand how the world works, space is not going to be one of the ingredients at the deepest level.
We've already done away with time, haven't we?
I don't know about that. Actually, I think that time is more likely to survive, but I'm willing to get rid of that too, if that's where the data and the theories lead us.
Why? Well, tell us how you can get rid of space. This is a new idea.
Well, much like we got rid of temperature and pressure and things like that by saying that fluids like water or the air are not in themselves fluids, they're collections of molecules. So at the level of molecules, there's no such thing as temperature or pressure. There's just individual molecules in their motions. And out of the collective behavior emerges what we call the properties of the fluid. So I think that things like space and time might very well emerge out of some more fundamental quantum mechanical description.
All right. If there's something there that you'd like to talk over tonight, having a beer with everybody, there are two good ideas from Seth Lloyd and Sean Carroll.
Seth is professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT. Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist at Caltech in Pasadena. And you can read both of their essays from their collection, The Idea Must Die. It's at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/thisideamustdie. Gentlemen, thanks again.
Thank you, Ira, for
making our hair hurt a little. We like that.
That's our job.
Take care. Have a good weekend. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about, something an app can do with food. You're going to like to, if you just take pictures of food like a lot of people do, we've got something useful for you to do with all those pictures. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Flip through your Instagram and your Facebook feed, and you're bound to find two things, right? Pictures of pets, sure, and pictures of food. That big, beautiful burger, the fresh veggies from the farmer's market, the roadside tacos from your friend on vacation. I'm getting hungry. Those pictures might make you hungry, but what would a dietitian say about that burger? Well, now you can find out. A new category of food coaching apps can connect you to peers and pros who are ready to judge what's on your plate and maybe suggest a healthier substitution for the next time, of course. My next guest has taken those apps for a spin, and she's here to give us a review. Lauren Good, Managing Editor of Reviews at Recode in San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday, Lauren.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this idea of food journaling. Is that what it's called now?
In some ways, it's food journaling or food logging, sometimes it's called. But, I mean, really, people have been logging their food or keeping some type of food journal for as long as weight loss programs have been around. And traditionally, they were done in a much more analog way. And now, with the rising popularity of smartphones, people are starting to use smartphone apps to do this. Mm-hmm. But it's not just food journaling. As you said, we've kind of progressed into this era of food coaching, which means that some mobile apps might offer a combination of digital data logging and the human element, pairing you up with actual human beings who can guide you through the app. And the big idea behind this is that, of course, it keeps the user a little bit more accountable if you have to answer to a human being or a dietitian within the app versus just an app that doesn't give you any kind of feedback and it's easy enough just to stop using it after a while.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of them. You've been using a food coaching app called Rise. How does that work?
Yes. Well, I'm actually no longer using Rise, but I did use it for about a month around the time of the Thanksgiving holiday because, you know, as we're gearing up for Thanksgiving, you start to think I'm probably going to be overeating a little bit and I want to keep things under control. So I used it for about 4 weeks. Rise is currently only available on the iPhone. And what it does is it charges you somewhere between $10 and $15 per week to pair you up with a dietitian or nutritionist who literally is sort of at your beck and call within the app. You can message that person all day long. You can ask them for advice for what you should eat at an upcoming meal. And you send them pictures through the app showing them what you have what you've been eating. And they offer immediate feedback on those meals.
That's pretty pricey. You've got to be very, very motivated this way. What'd you say, 10 to 15 bucks a week?
Per week, yeah.
It's not a 99-cent app you're downloading.
Right, exactly. I mean, you do have to be somewhat motivated, but once again, it kind of keeps you accountable. And the company has said that it's considering different pricing models. For example, maybe eventually for people that have met their goals, they might offer some type of maintenance fee where you're just paying to sort of still maintain a connection to the person, but you're not checking in as frequently as maybe you once were. And, you know, I found for the 4 weeks that I was testing it to be a very interesting experiment, but I'm not sure it is something that I would continue or that the average person could manage to continue doing for an extended period of time, given the pricing.
Does the coach yell at you if you go off the diet, or you know you're not eating fries today? You know, don't get fries with that.
The app will offer you a few different coaches that you can choose from when you first sign up for the app and fill out a profile. So you can choose one that you feel is maybe a little bit more tailored to your goals and what you're looking for. And if you're looking for someone who's really sort of going to get on your case, I'm sure you can find people like that. And if you're looking for people that are more gently encouraging, you can choose someone like that. And I found that mine was more encouraging than anything else. Here's an example. I would, you know, if I had a Mexican food for a meal and I sent her a snapshot of the food, she would say, okay, that's not bad, but maybe next time try to avoid something with all the tortillas. Or I would have almonds as a snack, which is great for a snack, but they're incredibly dense, as you know, and they can be high in calories. And she would say, why don't you limit it to just 10 and not have like a whole handful? And so there were things like that that I found she would sort of prod me along as I was logging my food.
But if dieting is not your thing and that what you're looking for coaching, there are psychologists and doctors and trainers and all kinds of people. It seems like the trend in these kinds of apps is personal trainers, so to speak, instead of just being a passive app that you use.
That is correct. There are some that are specific to dieting, like I tried. Another one was Noom that I tried for weight loss purposes. MyFitnessPal is a popular one. But in terms of the personal coaching, it's now extending into fitness. FitStar personal trainer is one that pairs you up with, you know, it gives you sort of personalized workouts. I've tested ones for medical purposes. I tested one called American Well that for $49, you can get a 10-minute video visit with a doctor. As let's say you have a cold, it's not something that would address a chronic issue, but something like more acute conditions, you can actually pay to just video chat with a doctor. And so a lot of apps now are starting to offer this combination of, it's not just about what can the app tell me, it's how can it connect me with real human beings.
But how do you know if that's a good doctor that the app is hooking you up to?
That is a great question. You kind of don't, and you don't have that kind of personal relationship that you would if it was someone that you were seeing in person on a regular basis.
And you know, wasn't there an app for skin, possibly for melanoma, taking pictures of it that was sort of, was it sued or stopped, the FDA put a stop to it?
Oh, I hadn't heard of that one, but if that is the case, I can see how that would definitely. That could definitely happen.
Mm-hmm. So what app did any one of these actually blow you away and say, boy, I'm going to keep up with this one after the testing period is over?
No, to be quite honest, I found that using them for a short period of time sort of did the trick for me. And then there are so many free options out there, whether it's MyFitnessPal, which was just acquired by Under Armour. Lose It is another popular one. And then even some of the apps like Fitbit and Jawbone offer some type of food logging. That to pay that type of fee for access to a person within a mobile app, I mean, it's not something I found to be necessarily sustainable. I will say that of the two, I really sort of dug into, which were Rise and then Noom. I found Rise to be a little bit more effective because I had that one-on-one attention with a personal coach, whereas with Noom, I was paying $10 a month to be put into sort of a group of like-minded, you know, food loggers, and we were all trying to sort of support each other through the app, but it didn't feel quite as personalized.
You know, we're now into the Internet of Things, where everything is hooked up to the Internet, even your bathroom scale, it might be Bluetooth over to your cell phone. Are we at a point where if you step on the scale and you're overweight, the scale is going to talk to you and say, uh-oh.
I'm sure that's coming, but there are Wi-Fi connected scales. You are absolutely correct, Ira. Fitbit has one called the Aria scale. Withings has one, and these are connected to your personal health accounts. And in some cases, you can even opt to send your weight to your social networks for some social shaming, if that's what motivates you. So you step on the scale, and within a few minutes, your weight actually appears in your Twitter and your Facebook feeds, which some people find highly motivating. I personally haven't really opted
into this. All the experts are saying that the people who are most influential in you changing your mind or being motivated are your friends. So maybe that is a good thing if you publish your weight up there, you know?
I mean, last year, or actually it was about a year and a half ago in 2013, there was a study done by Weight Watchers and the Baylor College of Medicine that found that people were more likely to lose weight by participating in something like a Weight Watchers as opposed to just doing a self-directed kind of weight loss thing. And that's because of the group interaction. So just signing up for something like this isn't enough. You have to go to the weekly community meetings. You have to check in regularly. And in general, people who are surrounding themselves, putting themselves in that social scenario, tend to be a little bit more successful with these goals. And so whether it's you're blasting your weight to your social network or whether it's you're actually taking the time to meet with people in person, I think any type of, you know, if you're not doing something sort of in this, what's the word I'm looking for? A vacuum. You know, you think in general it can really help people.
Well, Lauren, thank you for being our guide
through these new
Thank you for having
these
me.
New social apps. And Lauren Good is managing editor of reviews at Recode in San Francisco. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you. Imagine a swarm of microscopic robots small enough to swim through your blood vessels and attack a single cell. How do these tiny machines move? How do they work? Who made them? The more you ponder the details, the more fantastic it seems. Well, what if I told you that we've seen the first steps toward making these microscopic robots a reality? It's the dawn of the cyborg bacteria. Yeah, and it's the subject of our newest video up on sciencefriday.com. Video producer Luke Groskin joins us now to tell us all about it. Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Whoa, it sounds spooky.
It does. It sounds like something out of Hollywood, right?
It does. You know, something Michael Crichton might have come up with.
Exactly like Michael Crichton would come up with, or Terminator, or Innerspace. So many different novels and movies that have involved this sort of nanorobots. But I've actually seen these kind of nanorobots, and they're not what you would expect them to be.
Nope.
They're actually half bacterial. They're made out of bacteria.
So why do we call them a robot if they're bacteria? What defines that?
So here's how these little robots are kind of put together, and I'll explain why they're kind of more like cyborgs. So you take these swarming bacteria, these bacteria which have these flagella that are moving around, and you adhere them, you stick them to this epoxy, these little structures with different shapes, and in combination, because of the nature of the shape and the swarming behaviors of the bacteria, this little, you know, are half fake, half artificial, half organic thing,
yeah,
is kind of a cyborg. It's a mixture between natural and man-made, and that's kind of how we define a cyborg.
So you can instruct it like it was part robot to do things, to go places. I know in the video, it's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com, they turn little wheels, they push little arrows around.
So see, the great thing about working with bacteria is that they are little tiny motors. Each one has a little flagella, and that's the mm-hmm. best motor that you can create at that size, or that we've been able to find at that size. And then they also have sensing abilities. So E. coli is naturally sensitive to UV or pale blue light. And they, when you flash light on them, they stop wiggling their flagella and they start spinning. And so that causes them to stop moving. So if imagine all these bacteria stuck to this structure, and if you flash a section of that structure with this light, well, then that section of the structure where the bacteria were, they stop moving. And so that changes the direction that the structure's going in.
Mm.
So you can use the innate sensing ability of these bacteria to move these structures.
I'm Ira Flater. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with our video producer, Luke Ruskin, about his newest video. It's Dawn of the Cyborg Back in a World. I can't get that.
In a world.
Dawn, yes, exactly.
Of the cyborg bacteria. Now, you know, it sounds scary. Should we be afraid that he's going to escape the laboratory? Are they, you know, dangerous?
So the two researchers, Elizabeth Beattie and Denise Wong, they both went out of their way to reassure me that these are non-pathogenic bacteria. It's two different species, synthetically modified E. coli, mm-hmm. and another one called Serratia marcescens. Now, E. coli, the E. coli is very sensitive to light, and the Serratia marcescens has a very strong motor. It's a very powerful little bacteria. And their hope is to kind of mix them. But at no stage will they be creating our new future overlords. They promised me they would not do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
so promises. So the idea then is someday to be able to use these bacteria to maneuver stuff through our bloodstream and get into tiny places?
That's one of the ideas. This is still very early days in the research. They're creating different shapes to try to see how does the bacteria work with the shape in order to move the structure? How does the sensing actually work? And eventually they want to be able to use these in a medical environment. So you imagine being injected with some of these little nano micro robots.
Mm-hmm.
And they could target specific molecules or cells that you couldn't be able to do with a drug, or you could more easily do with a naturally sensing organic thing like bacteria.
Right. And so then they're just not figuring out how to manipulate. They're like little motors, these bacteria, right? They got a lot of tails on
them. Exactly. Exactly.
They push stuff around now, but they haven't figured out exactly how to move them where they want to get them to.
Yeah, and one of the great advantages of doing this is that the bacteria are self-replicating. Imagine manufacturing tiny little robots without these things on that scale. It's really hard to manage. Imagine how you would actually accomplish building little sensors and building little motors and building all of them on such a scale that they could actually do something.
So you were in the lab. It was exciting to be in the lab there filming this.
It was really fun to be in. It is a basement lab at the University of Pennsylvania, and they have these little colonies. And what was crazy is seeing the swarms. Bacteria don't just sit still. They swarm.
All right. And that's why, yes, it's called Dawn of the Cyborg Bacteria.
Indeed.
It's our newest video up on our website at sciencefriday.com. If you're scared, blame Luke Groskin. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
And you can watch it on our website. And if you like it, and you can subscribe to all our videos up there. Yeah, just click the subscribe button just beneath the video. One last thing before we go. Leonard Nimoy, the actor, director, poet, and photographer whom many of us knew as Mr. Spock from Star Trek, died this morning in Los Angeles at the age of 83. He joined us back in 1998 to talk about science fiction and a fundamental change he hoped to bring to sci-fi storytelling with his movie Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which he co-wrote and directed.
My hope when I did that story was that we would be successful or could be successful in making a film, science fiction, space opera, if you will, in which there was no malevolent individual, no heavy, so to speak, nobody that we needed to kill off by the end of the movie. There's so much of that in science fiction, and in fact, there had been so much of it in the previous Star Trek film, so much death and injury, that I thought I'd like to try the alternative, which we was quite successful with in the Star Trek series. And yes, I guess I do come to science fiction with certain thematic concerns that are social in orientation. I was very much interested in telling a story in which there was no specific heavy, but human nature being the problem and human foibles being the problem, and to discover what we could learn in that process. And it all came together very successfully. It doesn't always. My sadness, if I may call it that, comes from the fact that I see an awful lot of science fiction which is simply death and destruction. And since we have the special effects, why not blow up the White House while we're at it,
Yeah. Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock, passed out of our realm this morning at the age of 83. And you can listen to that whole interview at sciencefriday.com/Spock. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer, here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we've got the video Dawn of the Cyborg Bacteria up there, and you can download all of our videos, too. And if you want to see and watch them with you, take them along with you, you can download our app. We have both an iPhone and apps of all kinds up there. So download them and take them with you. And if you like us on Facebook. We continue a week-long discussion. Also on Twitter, at SciFry. And if you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Email scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flato in New York.